in every Wednesday, noon to 1 p.m. for Art Speak Radio. We serve up information about the visual and literary arts community, including live interviews with artists, writers, performers, musicians, art organizations, plus art supporters. That's Art Speak Radio every Wednesday, noon to 1 p.m., only on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
This is 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Terry. On today's show, our topic is healing and the criminal justice system. Reaching the pinnacle of her professional career, Mindy Corporon was in the middle of raising her talented boys when tragedy struck. Mindy's father and oldest son were murdered by a white supremacist intent on killing Jews. Mindy Corporon will discuss with host David Bell how her struggle and path to healing within the criminal justice system gave her new insight into how the system may be used to benefit victims and their families. You'll also hear how her unspeakable tragedy led to the creation of the Faith Always Wins Foundation, whose mission is to promote a dialogue for the betterment of our world through kindness, faith, and healing. We'll play our calendar at 9:30. We hope to build interest in creating positive change. Stay tuned. Thank you for listening to Jaws of Justice. We will not see justice unless those who are unaffected are as outraged as those who are.
Good morning. This is David Bell, and you're listening to Jaws of Justice on 90.1 KKFI. You know, I've generally focused, when I've had the opportunity to talk to all of you, on defendants, prosecutors, and the law. But if we're going to make a positive change in the criminal justice system, then I believe that all stakeholders must be invited to the table. And that includes victims and their families. They are stakeholders. And so designing a system that helps them move along the spectrum of healing benefits all of us within the system. And I will tell you on a personal note, I'm in awe of the strength, the grace, and the mercy that I have witnessed from victims and their families throughout my career as a criminal defense attorney. Perseverance in the face of what appears to be insurmountable obstacles serves as a testament to the strength of those around us. We have a lot to learn from victims and their families. And so with that, I am honored today to have Mindy Corporon joining us. Mindy, good morning.
Hi, David. Good morning. Thank you.
You know, if we could start with a brief description of your life prior to April 2014, and followed by then a brief description of what happened on the day of the murders, and then we can then stop there for a moment to reflect.
Okay, I will be happy to do that. And I heard you say brief, so I'll work on that. I'm from Oklahoma. I was born and raised in Oklahoma. I always say I'm a Sooner born and Sooner bred. I graduated high school in a small town in Oklahoma and Marlow, and then I went to the University of Oklahoma, moved to Kansas City right out of college, and then spent right about 27 years in Kansas City. Prior to April 13th, I was, and I still am, but I was married to Lynn Lowson. We had two boys. Reet, our oldest, was from a previous marriage of mine. And Reet was 14 at the time, and Lucas was 12. And Lucas is my biological son with Lynn, so we have Lucas together. We had Lucas really quickly after we got married because we wanted Reet to have a sibling, and so that's why the boys were close together. They're about 2 years and 10 months apart. I was the CEO and co-founder of a wealth management firm in Overland Park, Kansas, called Boyer Corporate Wealth Management. And that wealth management firm is still very prosperous and doing well. I am also a shareholder in that firm. I continue to be a shareholder and have a lot of pride in what I helped create and then what they've created since I've left. So that was before. My mom and dad lived in town. They had moved to the Kansas area. My younger brother also lives in town and is an attorney. And they live in town with their kids as well in the Overland Park area. That takes us to April 13th. So on April 12th, I always think it's important to let people understand how it was that my dad was with Reet and not me, or not my husband. And how that transpired was that on April 12th, we were having a family conversation, and we were discussing the next day's events. And Reet had an audition at the Jewish Community Center for Casey Superstar. This had been in the plans literally for several years, but specifically he'd been practicing for the better part of a year, and he had already had two other auditions to which he had been really passed. He had been admitted to and selected for Starlight Stars, which is a youth singing and dance program through Starlight Theater, and he'd also been selected for the summer play Tom Sawyer at Theater in the Park. So this was a trifecta for him. This was the third audition of the spring, and then he was going to have a very full summer and fall planned. And also Lucas, his brother, at the age of 12, had a lacrosse game the next day. And as it happens, you know, people listening who have children, grandchildren, and you're trying to help, you know, get them to swimming lessons or piano or dance or baseball, et cetera, things tend to happen at the same time. Events are scheduled at the same time. And Reed's audition was scheduled at the same time as Lucas's lacrosse game. And I had always expected that I would take Reet to his audition. There was just no doubt in my mind that I would be driving him and going to his audition. And when I made that statement on April 12th, Reet actually said, "Mom, I think you should go to Lucas's lacrosse game. You missed a couple of Lucas's lacrosse game last week. My husband and I had been on an anniversary trip. And I had, Lynn and I had both missed two of Lucas's lacrosse games. And so my mom couldn't take Reet. She was the next one to be asked. And she was going to be busy with my niece and nephew. And so then we asked my dad. And that is how my dad was the driver. And I went to the lacrosse game. And I walked into the parking lot of the lacrosse game, and it was canceled due to weather, which seemed really unusual at the time. It was a blue, sunny sky. It was a crisp day, but they canceled the lacrosse game, and I saw Lynn and Lucas very briefly, and then I drove to the J, the Jewish Community Center, knowing that I would get there before my dad and Reet, knowing that I would get there before his audition. His audition was to be at 1:30. And I pulled into the parking lot at 108. But at 108, I found my dad dead in the parking lot. And I didn't understand how that could have happened. I ran screaming to his body. I was wondering where Reet was, and I was screaming, what happened, but there was no one around. And as I got close to him, I felt a physicalness, something stopped me, but there was no one with me. But my whole body just halted, and it felt like there were something, they weren't really hands, it was just like this stopping point, and my body stopped about 2 feet from his body. And there was nothing I could do to help him. I could tell he was deceased, but I didn't understand how. And I heard the words, "Your father's in heaven, go find Reet." And the easiest path would have been to go around the left of him, to go around him to the left and into the J, but I didn't. I went around the right, and I went around the back of the truck, and that's where I found Reet in the arms of two men. And he had been shot, but I didn't understand. I didn't comprehend what had happened for really a while. And that was our April 13th. Within a few hours, we were told at the hospital in Overland Park that Reet had lost his life as well in the ambulance. And so I had this great life, and I have a great life, and we just had this horrible tragedy happen that stopped my life then and then changed the trajectory of everything that I do since then. And that's probably how you found me.
And thank you for sharing that, Mindy. You know, on your website, mindycorporan.com, you have a podcast entitled Shattered Soul, which is like podcast number one, in which you go into great detail of what you experienced on the day of the murder, much like you did here, but it's even more more descriptive. It's just so powerful, and I recommend it to everyone. And, you know, I've always viewed the soul as kind of the one absolute within me that doesn't change, and yet your use of the term and the description of your experiences that day made me rethink that. And I wonder, why did you choose that term, shattered soul? And what did it mean to you? And does it mean to you now? And what does that suggest in terms of healing for victims, and particularly for you moving forward, that your soul was shattered?
I learned later, David. I didn't understand it at the time. I've learned over the last 6 years that it was my soul that was shattered. It was to protect. It's almost like to protect myself. My soul left my body. My soul was shattered, and there was nothing I could do about it. The impact of what happened was so great that I was going to fall apart. And people wonder like you mentioned when you introduced me and you talked about victims in a very, very general sense about how do they go on. Our souls have some way of escaping for a period of time, and then for us to heal, we have to go find them again. We have to put them back together. And I had to learn that, and I learned that from a healer in town. I learned that from a woman named Cookie Harvey and other people that are in my tribe, Dr. Michelle Robin. I learned that from people who understand a different way of healing, and it took a while for me to understand it, but now I know that I've put my soul back together. It belongs to us, it's ours, but it's almost like it escaped so that somehow my body could function in this way that was necessary to answer questions. You know, Reet became an organ donor. I had to answer questions about that. I just looked up I knew I was going to be interviewing with you. I looked up my victim impact statement that I had to start drafting 9 days later. I could barely walk to the mailbox, but yet I was being asked to do things. You know, we had to plan a funeral. I mean, all of those things get done, and people wonder, how do you do that? And I think it's because there's some kind of a protection that our soul gives us, and mine was just shattered, and so I was operating from what was left of me at the time.
So let's talk then at that time, and whatever time period you believe would be relevant to the discussion. At some point, there's a thought about what you need at that point, and what you may have thought at the time may very well be different now. But I want to generally talk about what you as a if you use the term victim to describe yourself, what, and we can talk about using terms like that, but what you thought you needed, and then we can then go talk about what the criminal justice system offered you in that role.
Yeah, so I'll tell you what you need is you need your family back. You need them to not have been murdered. You really think about that almost 100% of the day is how on earth did this happen and what am I going to do next? So it is hard to move forward. There's only pieces of my brain that could operate. And people felt like I was functioning very well. They still tell me, they're like, you just functioned so well and it looked like you knew what you were doing. And I think I made good decisions at the time, but with the help of other people. You definitely need people around you. You need people that you trust around you that can help you, and they helped feed me. I mean, you need food. I am a non-eater. When I get stressed, I stop eating. Sometimes when people get stressed, I talk about this publicly, you're either an overeater or an undereater, and neither one of them are healthy. So there's no judgment on what you are. You just need to acknowledge what you are and try to be aware of it so that you don't, you know, hinder yourself. But I lost like 9 pounds. Within a few days, I just couldn't eat anything. And so I needed people to feed me, and they did. I needed people to remind me or help me understand tasks that needed to be done. The court system, the criminal justice system was completely new to me. The first time we met, Jim Lomano, who lost his wife, Terry, he's the widow of Terry Lomano. She was the third person murdered that day. We met him at Steve Howe's office at the Johnson County District Attorney's office, and that's just not where you want to meet anybody in any kind of circumstance. But they were very helpful, that they being the District Attorney's office, our experience with them was kind and compassionate and helpful. I remember one of our first meetings, I just couldn't control my tears. He was talking about the shooter, and how evil he was. They interviewed him, and he talked about how evil he was, but he was being very blunt about how evil he was, and I just lost it. I had to get up and leave, and they paused the meeting. They found me in the bathroom. They let me cry it out, and then I was able to come back. And they apologized for that, but I said, no, it's real. It's real life, but you have to experience my real life too. You know, and they did. And they allowed me to be real. They allowed me to cry through meetings. They allowed all of us to be angry. They allowed all of us to have questions. And I didn't initially think of myself as a victim. So yeah, when the victim impact statement came to me as something to fill out, I pondered that. Am I a victim? And in the criminal justice system, yes. But as a person, trying to move onward with my life, no. But am I worried about using that statement that at some point in time I was a victim of crime, my family was a victim of crime? I think that's necessary to help people understand where we were and who we are in a system. But again, as a person and going forward, I don't consider myself still a victim, or that I am at the mercy of someone else in that sense.
You know, one more thing. When you accepted my invitation to appear today, you asked for only two things. First, that I not mention the name of the shooter that murdered your family members. And second, that I had not asked about the trial itself. And of course, at the risk of asking one question too many, I then asked you if I could inquire as to the meaning behind these two requests. And you graciously agreed that I could. And so why these requests, Mindy?
Yeah, so I don't know a lot about the trial, and I can't speak to it much. We didn't go. We had a 12-year-old boy who, a year later, at the age of 13, was suicidal. And he was suicidal specifically two different times in his life, at the age of 13, at the age of 14. And unless people have heard my podcast or heard me speak publicly, they don't know that we went through that. They don't know that those first 2 years, we almost lost our other child. And a lot of that had to do with the trial. A lot of that had to do with the news that would come up, and we would have the TV on, and then all of a sudden my dad and Reitz and Terry's pictures would come up, and it was so jarring. I mean, we live it every single second of our life, and then it would come up, and it would be like, in your face, your family's dead, and this is what's going on. And it was just difficult. It's not that I'm saying that the news doesn't need to happen. We learned to turn off the TV. You know, we changed our lives. So I don't know much about the trial itself. There were three times that we went. We went when the sentencing was done. We went when the judgment was done, when he was found guilty, whatever that's called. We went to read our victim statements, and then we went during sentencing. So we went three specific times, and Lucas went with us each time. So regarding the trial, I just don't feel that knowledgeable about a lot of things, and it obviously brings up a visceral reaction for me, because during that time, Lucas was suicidal, and we were managing through that. And then we don't talk about the shooter. We don't mention his name. In fact, when people mention his name to me, I almost have to think, who are they talking about? Because I've not said his name. I don't Google it. I don't find it. Our family talked about and agreed early on that that man had been given a platform from the 1970s until he murdered our family. People knew about him. Many organizations who followed his type knew about him. A man that I interviewed in 2019 for 7 days, Make a Ripple, Change the World, I interviewed a reformed white supremacist named Christian Picciolini. He knew the name of the shooter. He knew about the murders. It incenses me. It is so angering to know that this man was known so well, and yet he was still out in public, out in the community. So there is no way that we will give his name any time. We don't want people to know who he is now, and who he was and what he believed in, and that we don't want to give him a platform. And that's why we don't ever say his name.
You know, one other thing that, and I know I talked to you about this before, is how do we as a society, but more so individually, respond to a victim in terms of what do I say? There's nothing I can say, Mindy, to undo the thing I want to undo. But yet at the same time, you mentioned your interaction at the Johnson County District Attorney's Office, and you know, you were crying, and that people ran into the bathroom and said, oh, I'm sorry about this. You said, no, this is part of the process. As an individual coming to you, as a friend who's been a victim, what do you want to hear from me? Or I assume you don't want me to leave you alone, because at that point I'm kind of pushing you away, which at the same time it seems like you would need something from me. But what is that?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I appreciate your care and concern for wanting to help people, for wanting to ask the question and wanting to know. You know, things that helped were when people just, I say just, when they just said, I'm sorry. Things that helped were cards that showed up 6 months later or a year later. Things that help are when people remember the anniversaries, not just the anniversary of the shooting, but remember Reet's birthday. You know, what happens when a life is taken from someone's family and the family has to start adjusting? So we had to go from a 4-member family to 3-member family, and really greater than that. When you include, you know, my mom, of course, and my brothers and other family members, our entire family lost 2 members on the same day. So when we gathered for a big Thanksgiving or Christmas, and it's not just a small unit, it's a bigger group, we had 2 empty chairs. And so what friends can do, what people can do, is remember those times in our life, because those tend to get forgotten. A lot of people, when a tragedy happens or a death happens or something happens, we all flock to that person immediately, and we want to help right then. And, of course, that's helpful. The people who fed me, totally necessary. I needed people immediately. But then you need people 3 months later, and you need people 6 months later. I'll tell you, David, I woke up on the 6-month anniversary of their shooting, and I didn't understand it was the 6-month anniversary until I looked at the calendar, and I woke up crying. And I didn't know, but my body and my mind and my soul were realizing that they were not coming back. I mean, there's this space in your brain that tells you it's really not happening. You're living through this nightmare, but it's not real. And you tell yourself that just to get through a day or two, and then a month, and then 3 months. But at 6 months, you can't tell yourself that anymore. You have to learn to live with it. And so at that point in time, I needed people again. And so, you know, as a friend, be available and say things like, I'm available. I'm available when you need me. Or just send a card and send a note. And those types of things are helpful. It depends on how close you are to someone. You know, if it's someone you're really close to, you're going to be bringing casseroles every so often. But if you're not that close, but you still feel something for them and you want to reach out to them, a card at any holiday is appropriate, because at that holiday, we are missing our people. Our people are not with us. And so that is really helpful.
Yeah, but it almost seems like, I know in my own personal experience with individuals or victims, there's a hesitancy there, as if I'm going to do or say something wrong that's going to somehow offend or hurt. But at the same time, I then wonder if that's just me worrying about my feelings rather than focusing on the very feelings of the person that I'm interested in helping.
Yeah, you're concerned, and it's understandable. You're concerned about saying something wrong, but you know what you're also concerned about? You're concerned about feeling the feelings that I have. You're concerned about taking on the pain that I have. You don't want to feel the pain I have, and I don't blame you. I don't want you to feel the pain. People who have lost a child, we know there is some raw pain that you don't realize as a human you can feel. And so it's human to not want to feel that feeling with me. That's called empathy. And we can be empathetic with other people and try to be in their shoes or try to listen to them. But if we don't want to be empathetic, we just want to be sympathetic, we want to stand around them and we want to offer some help to an extent, but we don't want to feel that feeling. And I understand. I wouldn't want to feel it either. But I have a different level of compassion now for people, because I know how deep pain can go. You know, I can go to movies now where people are crying, or I can see things that really affect people. And it doesn't affect me to the extent that maybe it should or it used to, because I have a different, I have a new normal of pain. So it is about you, and I don't mean that in a bad way, but you're right. People are worried about doing the wrong thing, because then you don't want to feel badly. I don't want to feel badly. I did the wrong thing. Well, you know, I'd call BS on that. Reach out and say, I'm sorry. Reach out and say, you know, this shouldn't have happened to you. Reach out and say, I'm thinking of you on Father's Day, or I'm thinking of you on Mother's Day, or I'm, you know, et cetera. I'm thinking of you at this holiday. Those are necessary to build empathy between people. And that, I know, that really takes me to, why did I open the company Workplace Healing? You know, corporations and businesses, we tend to say, when you show up at work, there's no crying. You know, you leave your feelings in the parking lot and you show up and do what you're supposed to do at work, because we need to have a return on investment. I was a CEO of a company. I know that we needed a return on investment for our clients and our business, but I couldn't leave my feelings in the parking lot. They came with me. And so I created, with the help of Lisa Cooper, a company called Workplace Healing, because I want corporations and organizations and businesses to understand that you are working with humans, and we need to have empathy and compassion for one another.
And Mindy, thank you for that. And I think we've set the stage now for our next step after the break, which is talking about how the criminal justice system provided assistance to you. And then we're going to move into some of the other things that you've done based on this unspeakable tragedy. You're listening to 90.1 KKFI Jaws of Justice.
Now, the calendar for the week of June 29th. In compliance with the latest version of Mayor Lucas' emergency order, certain business activities may resume while ensuring necessary public health measures remain in place. See the facts at kcmo.gov. Today, Showing Up for Racial Justice KC Points of Unity training is 7:30 p.m., an online event. Go to Standing Up for Racial Justice KC on Facebook for sign-up info. Monday, June 29th, 6:30 to 7:30 p.m., June Volunteer Meeting hosted by Advocates for Immigrant Rights and Reconciliation, AIRR, A-I-R-R. See info on Jaws of Justice Facebook page. Tuesday, June 30, from 4 to 7 p.m., Moore Squared will have a phone bank about the Medicaid expansion on the Missouri August ballot. Moore Squared has built a strong phone outreach system, and there's potential to engage thousands and thousands of voters between now and August. Contact Gary at moresquared.org to learn more. On Tuesday, June 30, Race and Your Rights, Discussion and Know Your Rights Training, 6 p.m., an online event, sponsored by Real Justice Network, ACLU of Missouri, and Kansas City Black Homeschooling Families. See info at Facebook for Kansas City Black Homeschooling Families. Tuesday, June 30, continuing the conversation, Racial Equity in Education, 4:30 p.m., an online event. Mainstream Coalition asks, where do we go from here? More information at mainstreamcoalition.org. A list of services, meals, and hotlines are available at lawrenceprogressivecalendar.blogspot.com. That's updated daily. Please take care of yourself and others. Thanks to all our listeners. Stay close to your dial and stay well. My name is Terry, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. We want to thank our engineer today, Stan Thomas. Please listen to Jaws of Justice next week.
Support for KKFI from Pete Brown and Kissick Construction on behalf of Harmony Project KC, flagship program of the Northeast Community Center. Harmony Project KC provides orchestral music and mentorship for children 5 to 18 in the urban core, narrowing the arts access divide in our city. Information for programs and events at harmonyprojectkc.org. Harmony Project KC, music for all.
Let's explore, let's question, let's decolonize together on Ebony's Bones.
Tune in every Wednesday from 6 p.m. to 7 p.m. on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Good morning. You're listening to David Bell on 90.1 KKFI, Jaws of Justice. I'm here today with Mindy Corcoran. We just explored with her experiences in April 2014 when she lost her father and son to a white supremacist intent on killing Jews in Overland Park, Kansas. I now, Mindy, want to focus on, and we kind of left off with your experience and as a victim individually, and you use that term to describe yourself, at least within the criminal justice system. I also want to explore that a little bit further now, and then I want to talk about how you have learned to deal with trauma outside in the workforce and other places in society, and what you're doing to help all of us understand that trauma exists at various levels throughout the world, and that we need to maybe seek on healing that to make a better life for all of us. But let's go back to the criminal justice system. What parts of the criminal justice system did you find to be most comforting and most helpful to you as you went through the system?
Yeah, that's kind of funny that you put those words together, criminal justice system and comforting. The victims advocacy program, that just kind of made me laugh when you said that, because it was hard to be comforted. Again, we were thrown into it. Luckily, I had never been in the criminal justice system. I'd had a ticket. I ran into somebody once, and I had to go and represent myself, but nothing, you know, really dire or heinous. And so I didn't know much about it. And again, we were in Johnson County, and Steve Howe was the district attorney at the time and still is right now. But he and his staff had great compassion. And I believe a woman named April, I was trying to think of her name. She's not there any longer, but she was our advocate. They assigned us an advocate, and I latched onto that. I'm all about having somebody be my advocate or me being an advocate for someone. So that was an amazing help to us. I mean, literally every step of the way, I could text her, I could call her, I could email her. She would communicate back to me as soon as she could. And one specific thing that happened to our family, again, we had a 12-year-old. Lucas was 12 at the time, and he was so angry. All of us deal with trauma differently, and he dealt with it as an angry youngster because he didn't have any other coping skills. And so he wanted to talk to the shooter, and he wrote out a list of questions for the shooter, and he wanted to talk to him, and he was very angry at us for telling him that we didn't want him to talk to the shooter. And finally, after several days, maybe a week, I called April, our advocate, and I asked her what we could do about this. And I said, I don't even know if it's possible. And she got District Attorney Howe on the phone, and he had us come in, and we went in, and we sat at a table with him and one of the assistant DAs, and they really listened to Lucas, and they answered questions for him, and they let him know legally that Lucas meeting with the shooter was not possible during the trial. But they also, you know, that was comforting to us. And then also they listened to him, and they let him ask questions, and they have children. I know Steve has a son that's Lucas's age, and he was very compassionate and empathetic with what Lucas needed from them. He wanted so badly to hear the shooter say he was sorry and didn't mean it or something like that. And Steve was really blunt and frank, and he said, I am so sorry, Lucas, that's not going to happen, but you can talk to me all about it, and we'll give you all the answers, as many answers as we can. And I am forever grateful for them helping us help him through that time.
As a victim in the criminal justice system, what's something that's most frustrating? And I'm going to throw a guess out there just from having kind of seen it as a criminal defense attorney. I think sometimes I get the impression that victims and their families don't know what's going on in the system itself, how it's supposed to go. Are we showing up today to do something? Is it continued again? What I'm wondering is that one of the most frustrating things? And if not, what is?
I think it would have been, but April, that's what I mean. As a victim's advocate, she was able to tell us what was going on. So yes, if we didn't know what was going on, she would let us know. And I was back at work. I was trying to work. We had a family unit. We had, you know, I was one of the key people she talked to, but then my brother, who's an attorney, stepped in and really helped because he knew the language a little bit better, the legalese. And so I know all families don't have an attorney to help them with certain things. But really, yes, I would say if we had not had access to an advocate or been in the advocacy program that they allowed us to be in, we would have been more frustrated. I was frustrated with how long it took. But, you know, I didn't have any control over that, and there's so I set that aside. I mean, I've learned that, you know, once my I learned at other times in my life that you don't have control over things, but when your family gets murdered in plain sight on a Sunday, you know you don't have control over things. And so that, to me, I can set things aside now. But, yeah, that's a simple thing for people to be frustrated about, that they want things to go quicker, they want things, they want to know what's going on. And to me, that's where they did a fantastic job from their office's point of view of letting us know what was going on and when. And then when we were needed and when we weren't needed, you know, I felt like I wanted to be available if they needed me, but I had my husband and other people saying, be careful how much you go and how much you get into it. And that was because Lucas wanted to be part of it. And if I was going to that courthouse, Lucas was going with me, and I didn't want him to go often. So I made sure and talked with the district attorney, Steve, and then April, our advocate, you know, when do you need me? When is it crucial? Because when I'm coming, Lucas is coming. So we made our decisions based on that.
Is there also something to waiting for the case to be resolved before you can move on in some way? I have that with clients sometimes, and I have to assume with victims that something is going to be put on pause until the case is resolved and there's a sentence, whatever it may be, until the case reaches its conclusion.
Yeah, I know that when it was over, people were saying that, oh, we probably had closure. And I would say we did not have closure. That chapter was closed. That section of our lives was closed. So, yes, I'm just trying to think back to how I felt at that time. I mean, we were still in a fog. I mean, you know, we didn't want it to last any longer than it did. I know that. Let me mention this. In our case in particular, it was a hate crime, but it wasn't prosecuted as a hate crime and federally. So again, you know the law more than I do, but my understanding is that it would have had to have gone to federal court for it to be processed as a true hate crime. But we wanted people to know it was a hate crime, but yet we were not willing to, once he was found guilty in that first trial, we did not want to continue pursuing it. Like, we didn't want to open up the case again and go through the federal courts because he received the death penalty. There's not much more you can receive after the death penalty. So we made some judgment calls there. So having it over was helpful because we also didn't need it on the news anymore. But there's not closure other than that chapter. I mean, Dad and Reet were gone. We couldn't get them back. I mean, was the trial helpful? You know, only to the extent it put this man away. I mean, literally only to the extent he's no longer in society. That's how it was helpful. And to understand that there are programs available through the court system that hopefully people do have access to and that they do use to their benefit that can help them, you know, move forward in life.
Talked about in our conversations you and I have had about mental health needs and how those were met by you and your family. I have to assume that's just an incredibly important part of the healing process.
Absolutely, David. You know, so like I said, when trauma happens, people all react differently. We all really kind of go, whatever our genetic disposition is, comes out. And at the time, as a 12-year-old, Lucas's was anger. My genetic disposition was to stay busy, create, do things. I started creating and working and doing, and I was sleeping less and eating less. And so we all did these things. And what was so key, I did go see a counselor by myself. I just saw a counselor. And then after a couple of years, my husband joined me, and then we sought counseling together as a married couple. a lot of people don't stay married after a child, dies from anything, because it's so hard to stay together. You have to work at it, and we did, and we got through it. But neither one of us were about to kill ourselves. Neither one of us became suicidal. But Lucas, as a 12-year-old, became suicidal. And I am so grateful and thankful for the access to mental health care that I had. And I worry so much, and I'm an advocate for young people to have access to any kind of mental health care. I need to be really clear for anybody that hears this. Lucas could not learn for 2 years. He went back to school, but he didn't learn very much of anything. We found out his junior year in high school that he was missing some specific building blocks. And when he was tested to find out what he was missing 7th, 8th, and part of 9th grade. His brain could not learn at that time. The trauma was so great. And so I think about, and he got care. I mean, we got care. So what our care did is our care kept him alive, and our care kept him in the family. And he learned normal things about life, but he didn't learn, like, certain things in math, and he didn't learn certain things in English. And so those were very specific things that he missed. And I think about all the children who are experiencing trauma just on a daily basis or in their lives. And if they are not getting care that they need, or people paying attention to them that they need, then they are going to miss something. They're going to miss some specific building blocks. So mental health care is so key. And I would just say I'm a huge advocate for all of the groups in Kansas City, but one in particular is Operation Breakthrough. I mean, they provide so much access and help to young children who many of them have trauma in their daily lives.
One other thing, and then I want to move on to how you're addressing trauma today in the workforce. But one of the things you brought up in our discussion was the importance of making victim statements. Could you talk about, is it the importance of setting down for a moment and writing it out? Is it importance of saying it? What was it about that experience that was so meaningful to you as part of your healing?
When you sit down to write out what you need to say to anyone about something that's traumatic that's happened to you, whether you're speaking directly to who did it to you, the culprit, or you're speaking to someone who just needs to know to understand what happened to you, what it did for me is it put me in a position of even more crying. So I cried anyway, but this was a cathartic crying. This was seeing it in a different light, and it was a healing process. So I cried through putting it together, and my words had to be so clear and concise because I wanted to get my message across. And I had a variety of different messages by the time I spoke live at the courthouse. And it was, yes, it's healing because you have an opportunity to really reach deep in with you and think, what happened to me and how do I feel now and what do they need to know about it? So that was helpful. I really thought that when I spoke it, I wasn't going to cry. I really thought I could speak about it because I'd already cried through the whole thing so many times writing it. And then, but I did when I got up there to speak it, emotionally, my whole body was shaking and I was crying because it was so difficult to say and read. And I don't think that it had to do that much with who was there, other than the shooter was 3 feet from me and wouldn't look at me, but he needed to hear it, and the judge needed to hear it, and other people needed to hear it. But you know what? I needed to say it. I needed to say it as much as people needed to hear it. I needed to say out loud to myself what had happened and what I felt and the horrible impact of what had happened. I mean, it's so hard to describe the impact of a death in your family, let alone the murders, you know, of my father and son. And so, yes, it was definitely a healing process.
You know, if people want to learn more about your experience and experience of others, I would recommend they go to MindyCorporan.com, and the podcast there, Beginning with Shattered Soul and Moving Throughout It, are just are unbelievable in terms of not only the experiences that are described, but also the strength that is evident there. I guess, Mindy, what I'd like to do, we have, you know, about 9 minutes left, and I apologize for the brief comment before. I'm trying to squeeze so much content that you've got so much to say and so much for me to learn into 50 minutes. And so I apologize even having to say the time limit, but I'm actually given one. But we have 9 minutes left, and I want to talk about how you have taken your experiences and almost paid them forward in a way in terms of helping others dealing with trauma, not only at the same level, to the extent we can say level of trauma, but for people that maybe experience less trauma, but are still impacted in some way that affects their quality of life and the quality of life of those around them.
Right. So a couple of things that you said that I want to give people permission. Everybody's trauma, everybody's life disruption, everybody's tragedy, whatever that is, if it's a car wreck, a bike wreck, even if someone doesn't die, it's yours. It, whatever feeling you have about it is your feeling. And if I said to somebody in another radio interview, they said, well, you know, how do you talk to people about who lost a dog and that's the only thing that's happened to them? And I would say, well, you know, I'm just not going to allow myself to really get that deep with that person. But that person who lost a dog, if that's the only thing that happened to them, it's their pet for life, that's impactful to them. And they deserve to be able to have sadness and grieve and have people comfort them. But yeah, that doesn't touch me that much. And sometimes I have to remove myself from people who want to go on and on about their children not being able to get into a college they wanted to get into, because that I don't want to hear about that. I don't even have a son who didn't graduate high school, he didn't graduate college, etc. And so as a person who's affected by that, we have to learn how to protect ourselves. But we also, I have learned in particular, that everyone has permission to have their own grief about whatever has affected them. So I wanted to say that. And then there's something, all the things that I do to pay it forward, that just makes me smile. It really does. So my dad, it was so great. He's a great man. And he did so much for people. And he taught me that that's what we do. And he did great things for people. And he didn't have a tragedy, you know, per se in his life that was as great as the one I experienced. But he taught me to be giving and loving. He and my mom were giving and loving. And he just had so much more life to give. And I have a responsibility to give that to other people. I have a responsibility on behalf of their lives to help. So I'm trying to pay it forward for three people. You know, myself and my dad and Reet. And so that's probably why I've just become this serial entrepreneur. I have that in my DNA, but I also feel a responsibility to do more than I probably humanly capably can, because I'm operating on behalf of three of us.
And so what are some of those things that you're doing now as part of this mission?
Yeah, so we opened Faith Always Wins Foundation first, and Faith stands for all faiths. So many people think of faith as just Christian, but it's not. It's Judaism and Buddhism and Hinduism and Islam, agnostic, atheist. We've interviewed and talked with and tried to educate people on all different paths of what does faith look like, faith in humanity. But we do talk about our own faith, you know, when we're there, but then we also share with other faiths. So the Faith Always Wins Foundation promotes dialogue for the betterment of our world through kindness, faith, and healing. And in the kindness channel, in the kindness lane, we created 7 days, Make a Ripple, Change the World. And in 2020, that experience happened virtually. So just like you and everyone else in the world, we stopped on a dime with COVID-19. We pivoted. And we created a virtual experience from what was a live experience. We put it all, made it all virtual, and now it's on a YouTube channel. So we went into YouTube and Facebook and really used social media to its fullest as far as we were concerned. And then I mentioned on the first half of the show that I most recently created a company called Workplace Healing. And we have right now we are promoting and selling, if you will, a 90-minute workshop, which is just the cream on the top of the cake. It is just the icing of all the information that we have to provide employers, managers, on how to help reintegrate your employees after they've had a life disruption. And you'll notice, David, I use the term now life disruption because everyone has something and everyone has COVID-19. We've all been life disrupted by COVID-19. And things that cause grief, things that cause disruption need our attention. And as a manager or an employer or supervisor, when you have an employee coming back into the workplace, whether it's physically the workplace or their home workplace, you want them to be there emotionally. You want them to pay attention. You want them to be present. And we help employers understand what to say, how to say it, when to say it. You know, you were asking those questions. It is so important to start having connection with someone who's had a disruption early, because if you don't, you could lose them, and they could leave your company, and that's what we try to stop from happening. So that's workplace healing, and we provide a 90-minute workshop, and then we do consulting on that as well. So those are the things that I do. And then really most recently, I met one of our mutual friends. I didn't know she was a mutual friend, but Dr. Nicole Price. And she is helping me facilitate a friendship group. It's 8 black women and 8 white women. And we put this group together on Reet's 21st birthday. And so she's helping me facilitate what does it look like to have friendships cross racial friendships, which I've had a few. I've had several, but now I'm trying to make that a bigger part of my life and of other people's lives.
Wow. So, you know, it was one of the things that you brought up, particularly about what you're currently doing now with workplace environment, is this idea of individuals suffering some type of trauma, some type of life disruption. I like that phrase. And they come back, and whatever it may be, and we say, all right, here's your 6 free counseling sessions, and I hope things go well. Or maybe you don't even say that. Maybe you have someone from HR go up to them and say, hey, you've got 6 free. But it sounds to me like from what you're saying, that's not enough at all.
It's not enough. And doesn't that feel like a disconnect for you? I mean, when you just said that, didn't you think, gosh, that's a disconnect? I mean, how is the manager going to know what's going on? Yeah, it sounds great to say, hey, I want you to come back 100%. Well, you know what? I can tell you, I didn't come back 100%, and I came back different. Trauma changes our brain. Trauma, life disruptions, they change who we are. They change how we behave. They change our mindset. They change our behaviors in some way, sometimes good and sometimes bad. And we need guidance along the way, and a manager, a supervisor should want to know how that process is going, rather than sending someone away and having no connection, having we call it a lifeline or the umbilical cord. We want the manager and supervisor to be part of the healing process. We want the team to be part of the healing process because we all need one another in life. As humans, we are connected, and that's where our energy is. It's within each other, and we need one another. We need our help to bring us back into whatever space we're supposed to be in at the time.
You know, when we were when we began our conversation, it was, you know, how do I approach you as a victim? And then we're talking about this, and I wanted to kind of bring those two together. It seems to me, and I guess it's a question, but that you knowing that I am sharing in your pain or your experience in some way has meaning to you. Is that correct? Meaning me walking across that abyss, that whatever that is that I'm scared to walk across to come up to you or to come up to the person at work that's come back from a tragedy and say, how are you doing? I'm so sorry. What can I do to help? Something along those lines brings some type of benefit to you. Is that right?
It brings benefit if I feel like you mean it. If I feel like you're willing to walk in the path with me, and you don't have to feel the pain, you won't. There's no way you'll feel the pain, but the fact that you acknowledge that I have pain, that's what we're looking for. We're looking for the empathy is to acknowledge that I had a life disruption and to acknowledge that you don't know the pain and you won't feel the pain, but that you acknowledge that I had it. To acknowledge that you don't know what to say is always healthy. To acknowledge that you care enough to say, I'm sorry and I don't know how you feel, but I'm here to sit with you and I'm here to help you in the process. That's what workplace healing is about.
It sounds as if it's the affirmation of you as a person and an affirmation of your experiences that potentially has the most meaning and the most ability to help to the extent possible.
That is right. How would you feel if you were ignored? How would you feel if you work every day with other people and something happens in your life and you show up and they look at you and then they bring up work And then you go away, and then they bring up work again. And how does that make you feel? Does that make you feel cared about in your workplace?
No, and then I could see that move to where people are then saying, oh, now she's acting weird. Maybe she doesn't want to be here, when in fact it almost becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Absolutely.
Mindy, you are wonderful. I thank you so much for taking the time and for your willingness to share with us such a tragedy, but then also the hope that has arisen from that tragedy and the work that you're doing now to bring a betterment of life for all of us here. Thank you so much for taking the time today.
Thank you, David, for caring about me and others. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. You're listening to Jaws of Justice on 90.1 KKFI.
It's the 420 drug war news. You know, folks, it seems like the whole nation has a bad case of indigestion of all kinds of thoughts and considerations. We've got the COVID-19, we've got the racial bigotry and much more that's stirring up things, so to speak. Well, here to help bring a little clarity to this, want to invite the executive director of the Criminal Justice Foundation, Mr. Eric Sterling, to join the discussion. Hello, Eric.
Dean, how are you?
I'm well. Would you agree there's a national indigestion, a lot of stuff going on right now, right?
I wouldn't call it indigestion. It's more like a fever.
Okay,
In which the stresses of both the coronavirus pandemic, the economic uncertainty, and then the indescribable horror of the murder of George Floyd all have combined to, in the last 2 weeks, create an incredible national reawakening of conscience.
Well, I thank you for, better than indigestion, I think. And look, Eric, the heck of it is that what happened to George Floyd is still happening. It happened just the other day at a Wendy's where a man fell asleep in a parking lot and then was shot in the back for the crime of sleeping, I guess. Your thought there, please.
The most recent killing and words like most recent only stand for a few minutes in this context.
Yes.
The most recent killing of a black man by a police officer in Atlanta is part of the dehumanization that exists in police training and in police thinking about the people that they encounter and people of color especially. These are over and over and over again situations that don't require violence but are escalated by the police training, by the police culture, into conflicts in which police create the circumstances in which they become afraid.
We'll have part two on Tuesday. I am Dean at drugtruth.net.
Sitting here in my problem. What am I gonna do now? Am I gonna make it? Some way, somehow. Well, maybe I'm not supposed to know.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. You can always listen to us live and find our podcasts on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. This is Jamie reminding you our outro music is Better Man from the Playing for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Cowtown Conversations on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Monday Morning Medicine Show with Dr. Mike, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hoag. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m.